Well, hello there and welcome to this live stream on the 30th of June 2020. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Great to have you on board and welcome to this last show of the old financial year. It's great to have you on board. We've got a lot of people on the stream already. It's looking pretty interesting. Oh, damn, I'm ready to go.
Hi, Martin.
Hello there. Great to see you and to have you on the stream tonight. It's going to be a really interesting conversation. I think there'll be some really interesting discussion as well. Lots of questions already from the live stream and also from the questions beforehand. I guess we should make a couple of introductory remarks, which I'll just do now. And of course, the first thing to say is this isn't financial advice tonight. This is just interesting observation, opinion. But if you need financial advice, go talk to a financial advisor. Please play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs. We are moderating tonight. This is as at the 30th of June, if in fact you're watching this later. If you want to get at my attention, use that Walk the World. And the super chat's enabled, so if you want to make a contribution to DFA, you can do that. Or if you want to make sure your question gets noted, you can do that too. So without further ado, Damon, I want to come across to you. And I guess a good place to start would be for you just to give a little bit of an update on yourself and what you do, because people may not know about you.
Yeah, sure. So we're an investment and superannuation fund manager. We started about a little over 3 years ago. We've been running money for just under three years. We've got one more month to have our three-year anniversary. Before that, I worked had a long history in the finance markets. I've worked for a whole bunch of different stockbrokers over time. The three most recent ones that are probably the most pertinent is I helped start Aegis Equities Research, which was an independent research house, and I helped start that just as the tech boom was getting underway. And then sold out of that, and just before the financial crisis. Then I spent about 6 or 7 years at Wilson HGM as a strategist there, doing quantitative analytics and doing asset allocation. Before spending 3 years with Schroders in the global quant team, sort of running, they ran about 60 billion Australian dollars at the time, and just looking at stocks globally from a quantitative perspective, and that was where we wanted to then take a step out and start doing that myself, because I could really see this this gap opening up, especially for some of the lower balance clients, where people who have sort of even 200,000 or 400,000, where financial planners just weren't really interested, and we're even seeing that sort of even spreading out even further now post Royal Commission, where financial planners are really trying to lift up and say, well, we have to spend so much time and so much compliance behind it. We're going to have to lift our balances. And we wanted to sort of come out with products that we could give to lower balance clients with, $30,000 or $50,000 that would still fit the needs that that you'd get from an institutional quality product.
Yeah, great. And we should say that there's no commercial relationship between DFA and Nucleus. This is just a mutually interesting conversation which we're sharing rather than anything else, just to scotch any rumours or anything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we treat that very much. One of the big things I'm trying to do is be extremely transparent in what we do in our fund, because we don't want it to be this black box where, we saw a super fund last year or the year before where somebody wanted to know how much they had in carbon within their fund, and they had to end up taking them to court to try and work it out. We're saying that we're open. We podcast every week. We're happy to go on Martin's show and ring him on ours to discuss and be open about what we're thinking about markets, because we want people who invest with us to know what we're thinking. So if they don't like it, they can go somewhere else, and when they do like it, they can come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've got a presentation. Do you want to run through that as a sort of initial intro before we start the conversations? How would you like to structure it?
Sure. I think it probably puts a bit of perspective around what we're thinking at the moment, because we've written a few pieces recently that have sort of been quite popular, and they're really focusing on some of these issues that I think are quite key in terms of financial markets right at this moment.
Okay, so I'll put the first slide up and then tell me when to change.
The
slide is now full screen.
Yeah, so we can see bubbles, robots, and the second chances to sell. So I'll jump straight in, because what I want to try and do, and I'll run quite quickly through these. If if you're looking for more info, we've got lots on our blog or podcast as well on these issues. But I just wanted to focus on, you know, what creates bubbles, have a bit of a look at robots, momentum traders, and what they're doing in terms of the market and how important it is. And then this idea of it isn't often that markets sort of give you this second chance to sell, and we think market is giving you investors this real second chance to sell out if they missed the first one back in January, February. So in terms of creating a bubble, there's four parts you can get in terms of making sure you've got enough money coming into these bubbles. So the idea from my perspective is you only get bubbles when you've got this disconnect between the fundamentals and what's happening with the prices. And this disconnect is actually very different in that most of the time what happens is prices go up and earnings are going up in a particular sector, and the market gets really excited about a sector, whether it's the internet or the housing sector in the US or whatever it is, and over extrapolates and thinks it's going to go on forever, and you markets sort of follow it up. This is quite different in that the floor's fallen away from this one. You know, the prices are probably down, well, from the start of the year, they're only down pretty marginally, and in some indices are actually up. And so prices are pretty similar to where they were, but the earnings have really fallen away. And based on how these things play out, they're not coming back anytime soon. And so that's where the disconnect, we're sort of basically seeing in terms of negative downgrades to earnings, it's in sort of the worst, 5 or 10% of cases you see throughout the over time, whereas the earnings valuations are right at the top in terms of they're in the top sort of 5 or 10% of valuations that you see. So getting to this bubble, there's four things driving it in my view. First is the one up on the screen, these new brokerage accounts. So I've got the three of the sort of biggest ones in the US, and this doesn't even count the new one that's added the most, which is Robinhood. A lot of people probably would have heard about that one because it's the popular one amongst millennials. In total, they've added about 9 million new accounts just this year. And to put that into perspective, and when I say 9 million, there will be some double counting. There'll be people who already have accounts out there. In perspective, there was about 17 million brokerage accounts in the US as at last year per household. 17 million, let me try that again, 17 million households that had a brokerage account. So there is a big difference between the, it's a significant number of new investors. And so some people will go back and go, well, yeah, how much is your average 22-year-old with a $5,000 balance drawn down off the credit card going to make a difference to the whole market? And they're right, not a whole lot. But if you get enough of them, and if they use some leverage, then that can make a significant difference. And that's what the next chart is showing. The next one's showing they're not using leverage. So in terms of margin lending, what they are using is leverage in terms of using derivatives. So this next one is just showing that back in 2001, you can see that both the stock market and margin lending sort of both rose at the same time before falling away at the same time. We saw the same thing happen in 2007, 2008. So a lot of that bubble was driven by people lending. In this latest one, that hasn't been the case. The next slide, though, shows where option values has definitely increased. So the idea is that if somebody comes in and says, here's my $5,000, I'm going to go out and buy the market. That doesn't make much of a difference to the overall supply and demand, and the market won't go up that much. But if that same person goes out and buys call options with, say, a 10-to-1 ratio of so that they're hoping to make 50 grand, but with a pretty good chance of losing the lot, then that does affect the market a lot more because all the market makers actually need to hedge that and go out and buy the market themselves. And so, option prices running, option volumes running about twice what they usually were. And that's very much focused on the retail accounts are very much into that. The next one, that's just showing that point again, is that... picking a few retail accounts, E-Trade and Interactive Brokers, where you can see the same bit where the number of options they're trading is just dramatically higher, more than double what they used to trade in terms of those volumes. Then you get the last way. So we sort of the four ways you can keep pumping new money into this. So you've got new investors coming in. You can use more debt, and we're not seeing more debt, but you know, it is potential that could gear up. We are seeing lots of derivatives. And the final way is you can see people switching between asset classes. So people who have already invested money might switch from the bond market into the equity market, and that will help sort of pump the market up. And so what we're looking at here is a survey that goes out. It's the Bank of America survey, and it's only it's about a week or maybe 2 weeks old. And they survey fund managers as to whether they think the market's overvalued or undervalued. And right now, fund managers are saying it's the most overvalued it's ever been since, you know, it's been running for about 20 odd years, and they think it's the most overvalued. If you look at what they're doing though, on the next one is they're actually been out the last month. They've been actually out buying equities, so they've been reducing cash and buying equities and buying you know, small cap stocks in particular. And so, despite the fact that they're talking the talk, but not really walking the walk, in that you're actually seeing fund managers actually go against what they're saying that they're seeing in the market, and that's what we're. You didn't see that last month, but you did see it this month. And we think that's a bit of the fear of missing out, or FOMO, as a lot of people call it, in that people are, you know, worried about missing the bounce and then just starting to pile in. So they might have got out of the market, you know, as the market was falling or towards the bottom, and then the market bounced and they sort of sat on the sidelines. And then they finally went, gee, you know what? I'm missing out. I really better jump back in again. And we think that's been this final push higher. And you can see on this final slide is that you can see hedge funds, which is sort of one area of the market, they're close to as high as they've ever been. Now, this is actually usually a negative sign. And the reason why it's a negative sign for the market is what it means is that all these hedge funds have already bought into the market, and it means that there's only one way for them to go, or close to only one way for them to go, in terms of the next move is them starting to sell down. And so, you know, when everyone's all on one side of the boat, the danger is, you know, they all start moving back to the other side of the boat. And so it's a more negative sign than you'd think. And so what we think is this final part of the market rise really has been driven by the retail, a mix of retail investors, derivatives, and people who are worried about missing out, sort of finally buying in and reallocating back into the market. And so the danger from here is that you then get the reversal happen. And especially as we hit this end of 30 June, and a lot of superannuation funds in Australia or pension funds elsewhere have these benchmarks where they've decided to be, you know, 60% equities and 40% bonds, or they've decided to be 80% equities and 20% bonds. And so pretty much and they just keep rebalancing back to that. So the end of quarter happens, and because they owned equities and equities have risen a lot over this quarter, they then, instead of having 80%, they've got 85%, and they've got to sell that 5% back down again, and which is then sort of the impetus to sort of start pushing the market lower. So that sort of gives us a background of what we're seeing. I think in terms of comparisons, there's two different comparisons I like to make. One is the tech boom, where because the big question behind this is, if it is a bubble, how long is it going to last for? So if you're looking at the tech boom, look, that lasted for years. You sort of had at least 18 months of really bubbly prices and driven by sort of similar factors. But I think there was a lot more, there's a lot more of truth behind that grain of truth, in terms of, was that things have changed, and we're going through this massive paradigm shift, and there's all this new money that's going to be made. And so there's sort of this grain of truth behind it. I think there's a more analogous time was the Chinese stock bubble in 2015, which where the Chinese stock market really ran up on the back of a lot of retail investors and a lot of margin lending in particular. It was all this faith about the government, and the government would have you back, and central banks would be, you know, similar to what we are now. Central banks would come and solve all the problems, and the stock market would just keep going up forever. And that then came to, that sort of took about 3 months before that finally came to an unhappy end. And so we think that's probably closer. So it's probably more like that. I could probably go for another hour on this one, Martin. I might maybe jump quickly past these last two. I think there's, I'm just sort of talking about robots, momentum traders, and I've got a lot of stuff up online about it if you're interested. But I guess what I'm trying to say here is there's a lot of people whose idea, who run off this thing called momentum. And momentum basically means if a stock goes up, you buy it, and if it goes down, you sell it, which sounds pretty simplistic, and it is. It's actually surprisingly effective for a lot of the time. It tends to make a lot of money consistently, and then all of a sudden blows up a lot of money. And so as long as you miss those blow-ups, then you do really well out of it. But net, it's a winning strategy over the cycle. And so there's a lot of hedge funds that use it. There's a lot of commodity trading advisors. There's a lot of quantitative funds. There's a lot of smart beta strategies and exchange-traded funds that do it as well. And retail traders, anyone who uses technical analysis is effectively using it. I can draw a line and a chart goes up, and that's why I just keep buying stocks that are going up, and I can try and sell stocks that are going down. And so and that's coming back to this thought from us, is that, you know, the bounce off the bottom was a genuine, you know, you get these bear market rallies, but there's so many more momentum traders and robots in the market at the moment that's really pushed this push what would have been a normal bear market rally into something bigger, and given this real disconnect between what's happening fundamentally and what's happening in terms of prices and markets. So maybe Martin, I might leave it there and open up to questions if that's...
Yeah, okay, yeah. Great. Let's just switch it back. Hang on. All right, okay. So there was a bunch of different questions. One basically came in before the show tonight was, there is a disconnect between the real economy and the stock market. You've just explained essentially why it is that the stock markets are going off where you are. You didn't mention central banks and their liquidity.
Yeah, I didn't actually. That's definitely in there. And I think of that as part of that asset switching in terms of the stuff I've written and all that. It's usually in the asset switching part where central banks are in buying assets from they're buying government bonds generally, and they've started buying corporate bonds. And the idea is that those investors from there are then ending up in equities once they leave. The issue is, as we go on though, is just to put in perspective the numbers, because I think it's important to have an idea of what the big picture numbers are. So the US, the central bank there went from about $4 trillion to about $7 trillion in assets in terms of how much it's been buying. The U.S. Debt, so the amount of government lending, is expected to increase by about another $4 trillion over the next 6 to 12 months. So the central bank's got to do at least what it's just done so far this year, and more over the next 6 months if they just want to keep running where they are. Plus, then the corporate debt market is needing more money because there's companies that are losing money, and we're seeing companies fold and go broke, and there's capital raisings going on. And so if they want to add more money into the piece, they've actually got to do more than what's happening at the moment. And so there's a bit of front loading from central banks, and so we think that did make a difference. That's actually probably the biggest place where, if this bubble is going to keep on going forever, then it's going to be central banks that's going to drive it. So if central banks keep spending it at increasingly high amounts, then that could certainly drive the bubble higher. And it's a very ironic position you end up in, is because what the argument is basically, look, central banks have suspended capitalism. Capitalism doesn't matter anymore because they're going to buy everything. And therefore, my response to that is I should rush out and buy as many stocks as I can, which is a very ironical sort of take on it. So if you have faith that central banks will do everything and more, then there's, you know, that's where the best chance of further upside is. My take is that we're starting already to see cracks in that. Hertz going broke, Virgin. There's plenty of airlines in the US. We saw Big Shale oil gas one the other day, Chesapeake. Companies are starting to go broke. They're going to keep going broke. Small businesses, in particular small and medium businesses, make up about 70% of most economies. They don't have listed debt. Central bank can't go out and buy shares in these companies that are going, in the small and medium businesses that are going broke. They can't go out and buy debt in those companies. And so that's the real, real issue in terms of that is how can you bail out that small and medium business sector? And I don't know how. And I don't think any central bank, I haven't seen any suggestion from any central bank as to how they can do it.
No, that's interesting because, of course, most of what the Fed has done is effectively bailing out the big end of town and big corporates and the financial system rather than, I mean, they have the PPP, which is effectively the money flowing indirectly, but it's relatively small.
And a lot of that went into the big companies. I mean, the Australian government tried to do something similar with, I think $40 billion was the headline amount. And I think based on our numbers, last I looked was actually, I probably haven't looked for about three weeks or so. So, but I don't think anything's changed. We thought they might get four of that 40, might actually be how much they actually lend. It's very tough because the issue you have is you lend to a small business and the next thing that small business goes broke, but their brother-in-law just got paid out to, do all the fit out of the new shop or whatever it is. And all the assets are now in the wife's name and you're sort of ripe for fraud in that area. And it's just very, very difficult to lend to that area, which is why they generally don't.
Yeah, great. There's a question here from Paul, which I think follows on quite nicely. This is from Paul Jones. Can you ask Damien whether QE may make cash more risky than, say, an inflation index government bond?
At a certain point, yes. I think we're a while away from that, though. I guess for me, the argument here is basically that central banks will keep spending and governments will keep spending and eventually you'll have so much money out there that this wave of inflation will come. And so if you're holding cash, then you're going to get left behind. And so inflation-linked bonds are a very good way, if you're worried about that, to get exposure because those inflation-linked bonds go up at the rate of inflation plus a little bit. And so you're going to stick with that. The issue is... we're facing this big hole. We've got underemployment of about 20% in Australia, very similar levels pretty much around the world. So there's a lot of people who want to get back out and to get jobs. There's this big hole because those people aren't out spending money and so they're not creating extra demand. Companies generally have excess supply and particularly in China. And so... If there is extra demand, they can very easily meet that demand. So my issue about is that I think you will reach this point where I think the wheel's going to spin for a while, where we just don't have the demand or the supply to actually cause inflation. And then at some stage, those wheels will bite and you'll get this big burst of inflation. And central banks are pretty keen not to jump on the first sign of inflation, I think. So they probably will let things run hot. It's just a question of when. I think we're still a couple of years away from that, but it could be sooner. But at that point is where you really, cash isn't going to be as much of a worry. But I do think we've got a decent sized canyon to get across before we've got to worry about inflation getting away from us yet.
Sounds like building that bridge a bit further. James asked an interesting question, which is sort of... a little bit following on perhaps as well. Are you bullish on anything right now? Are you mainly in cash or Bitcoin or puts?
Not in Bitcoin. We run very simple portfolios. I probably should have said that. We run cash. We run cash in different currencies as well. We run Australian government bonds and we run blue chip equities. So the top 1600 stocks globally, which is about the top 70 Aussie stocks. So we're only doing very high quality and very liquid assets is what we invest in. Put options is a potential for people. It's not in our mandate to do derivatives. So we're just doing the very simple assets because these are the ones in people's super funds and in the sort of, we think of ourselves as this core, the nucleus of someone's assets where we don't want to be taking high risk or any risk with, not any risky, sorry. We don't want to be taking large risks with people's money. So put options are useful, except the issue is when the fall happens. If it lasts another 6 months, it's going to be very expensive to run put options. So if you get the timing right, it's very profitable. But the big issue is timing. Bitcoin, not a fan. I don't think it's a high quality asset. sorry, what was the last one? The last one was cash. Oh, cash we have in certain elements. We've got some so what we're holding is a mixture of international cash and Aussie cash, government bonds, and close to minimum weight in terms of equities that we're holding, and we're sort of tilting that towards the equities we think are going to do better out of the corona, out of the a virus situation than ones that are not. So we're not trying to buy the sort of beaten down airlines or cruise ships or any of those types of ones yet.
Yeah, okay, great. Now there's a follow on from that. What about gold and silver in a portfolio?
Yeah, so look, they're not, they're sort of ones where we don't have them within our portfolio in terms of the physical metals. It's just not one of the assets we're allowed to buy within our mandate. But we do have a lot of gold miners. I think certainly way more gold miners than we've had at any point in it, to date. The issue I have, though, is gold is, I'd like to buy some more gold, but we're waiting for the market to pull back a bit further. We do think there's, as I said, we've got a big weighting. If the markets do pull back, though, we do think it's likely that gold will still fall. And then we'll sort of use that as a bit of a chance to buy some more.
Yeah, very good. And of course, so there are big debates about the future of gold. You know, if you talk to Harry Dent, as I do from time to time, he thinks that gold is way overvalued. It'll come back. Although he said it might go up again later. There are other people who think it's going to 5,000 or plus. So depends on inflation, deflation, who knows?
Absolutely. And the biggest issue, the reason why we have gold, and that's a very good point, the reason why we have gold, because I'm not a big believer in that, you know, as an asset, all it is you know, it actually costs you money to own gold. You have to store it somewhere. And we basically dig it up out of the ground and then we go and bury it somewhere else. And so it's not a it's not an asset that I think is it's an asset where it's actually a currency. This is the way we think about it, in terms of it is difficult to make more of it. There is a fundamental demand for it, and there is a lot of people who are who think it's very, very important. And so we look upon that and say, well, if all these governments are printing lots of money, where could that end up? We could easily see that could end up in the gold price going higher. But as I said, it's not really a core holding for us. It's one that's more of a strategic one to try and work out which stocks might actually benefit if markets are falling.
And it's worth saying, I think, isn't it, that the thing about the gold is, as well as the physical gold, you've got all of the options and futures and other trades. And many of those markets, I think, are quite heavily manipulated and oversold and, you know, multiple leverage to the physical, so that you've always got this, what are the other guys doing, the big banks holding as well. So that's another risk.
Absolutely. And if you, I mean, that's, if you look at most metals, and you say, okay, what's the actual physical use for this? So let's say we're looking at even another precious metal like platinum or palladium. You look and say, here's what industry needs. And then there's this little bit on the end is like, well, what are investors doing? And so if I'm looking at demand and supply, you can get the feel for that. On gold, it's completely different in that the uses, the actual uses for it are very, very small. The real swing factor is basically what's everyone else doing. And the biggest part, though, is what are central banks and governments going to do? Because if any of those decide to sell their gold holdings, that'll wipe demand out for years. And so, you sort of that your decision has to be: do I think central banks or governments are going to do anything imminently? Because if I do, then look out. Then it's second guessing what other investors are going to do, and then finally you look at actually, well, what's it used for, and is anyone actually going to use it as an industrial purpose? So it's a very different commodity to every other commodity.
Yeah, that's a good point there. This is an interesting one, which we could have a long debate over, but we'll have a short debate over it, okay. Which is, are Australian banks undercapitalised? Discuss.
what's the term the government uses? They've got more capital than they need. But
very, very, very strong, you know.
Yeah, unquestionably high. Unquestionably high, yes. Yeah. So that we will question it, though. Look, the big issue for me is, I think it's not quite a binary outcome, but it's not far off. It's basically saying if you could pump enough into the whole system that you manage to keep house prices where it is, maybe the central bank starts lending directly, you know, some starts backing the banks to get the lending out, or there's all these new things and you can keep prices up, then and so prices don't fall too much, then they've got enough capital. But I sort of feel as if your other part is they don't quite make that, or they're too slow or too late, and you do get a big tumble in house prices, then I think the Aussie banks are going to need more capital, absolutely. And look, I mean, the APRA told us that they said, look, these guys shouldn't be paying dividends, or you know, they need to think very carefully about whether they're paying dividends. So there's definitely real and considerable risks out there that the regulatory agencies have thought enough about to tell the banks that they need to, you know, seriously consider about whether they should or not shouldn't pay a dividend, because they're going to need extra capital. And so, that sort of feeds back to saying, yes, there is lots of situations where they're going to need more, they're undercapitalized for, and there's a number of scenarios that where they've got enough capital. So,
And my perspective there is the critical thing is what happens to the bad debts, right? Because as soon as loans effectively are classified as bad, they need a whole lot more capital than they do currently.
Yes,
so exactly. It actually comes back to whether APRA will continue to allow them to have these loans that are effectively suspended in terms of repayments, right? For as long as those actually don't go bad and aren't classified as bad, they probably have enough capital. If that were to change, or if the default rate started to rise dramatically, that's when the capital question really comes into focus, and there will be some banks who will be quite badly exposed, in my view.
Yeah, but I guess, would you say, though, it's a pretty odds on that APRA will change the rules?
Well, APRA has basically given them a leeway, and I think they'll go on kicking the can down the road, because the last thing that they want to do is to put more pressure on the banks. And, of course, they've said, well, you know, those capital buffers that you created, you should be running those down now because it's the right time in the cycle to do that, despite the fact they didn't have any counter-cyclical buffers previously. They've sort of shifted the goalposts just a little bit.
Yeah, I know. And look, there's this part where, you know, it is that problem, isn't it, that they set up all these rules, but then when the crises happen, and we've seen this overseas, it's not just Australia, happens in the US, happened in Ireland and other places as well, is the regulators will do everything they can to change the rules to try and let people just sort of keep going with the without needing to draw down that capital until they absolutely have to.
Yes, well, they want to maintain the illusion that everything's fine, and you know, a bit more debt will solve the problem. So the fact that we've got some of the most over-leveraged households in the place, take a bit more debt. You know, just kick your loan down a bit, no problems. My concern is that that's probably not necessarily going to be a really good place to end up, but you know.
No, that's right. And actually, that's a good point as well about that. You know, even if you had a view that, hey, everything's fine with this, we're going to bounce back in 6 months' time, you know, come Christmas, we'll have forgotten about coronavirus and everything will be off and running, is even if that was your view, you've had 9 months of really poor cash flows for a whole bunch of industries. And so basically you're going to say, well, we've got the same economy we had, you know, a year ago, except with all this extra debt that all these people have built up. Not governments have built up, individuals have built up, corporates have built up all this extra debt. And so that's sort of, that's sort of one more issue where, you know, more debt isn't going to solve this problem.
Yes, and the issue I have there is that people seem quite willing to sort of just allow the debt almost sort of to rise. And, of course, they argue that fact is that interest rates are really low, so it's affordable. But of course, the capital still ultimately has to be repaid in the neoliberalism world that we're a part of.
Oh, you're a starry-eyed optimist there. Surely you can just pass that on to your kids.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, you know, Japan has 40 and 50 year mortgages.
Yeah, that's right. So, but it's next stop. but yeah, I mean, it's more the risk. I guess what I think about it in terms of there's one side of that, but the other side, can you afford it? The other side is the risk side in terms of saying, if I'm sitting there with I own 50% of a house and the house goes up by 10%, then I've effectively made 20%. If it goes down by 10%, I've lost 20%. Now, if I've got only a 10% or a 5% buffer, all of a sudden, you know, quite small moves in prices make a massive difference. And so the problem you end up is you just end up with a society that's a lot more fragile and a lot more, you know, you start, you give everyone all this debt and all of a sudden everyone's got, you know, 80 and 90% mortgages. Now the whole economy can't afford for house prices to go down at all, and you have to keep throwing more money at the situation just to keep house prices where they are. And so, yeah, you're making a very fragile society if that's the way you're going and running the risks that there's going to be much bigger problems going forward.
Well, what could be wrong with 95% first-time buyer loans, you know?
No, that's right.
By the government.
Yeah, that's right.
Prices will never move 5% lower, will they?
Yeah, no, that's yes, well, you know, that's, it'd be interesting to see whether we get tales of that coming out you know, closer to election. I'm sure there'll be a few Labour politicians and Green politicians wanting to store up a few of those.
Well, I've already seen in some of my surveys that some of the highest levels of stress are in those who actually bought recently, you know, literally in the last few months, right?
Yes.
Prices have already started to slip in some areas, and so they're actually lost. They've lost that 5%, and so they're now sitting at zero or below. They've got all this debt. Now, interesting, of course, if things go worse, those secured government parts could actually be at risk. The government may need to pay them out.
Yeah,
oh, which absolutely. Wasn't how it was meant to be.
No, that's right. And the second part behind that is our mortgage brokers in Australia aren't particularly well capitalized. So we're already on the hook for, you know, that you don't need very many houses, yeah, just to start defaulting before they're all done, and the government's got to step in and start nationalizing some of those.
Well, next week I'm going to actually reveal the June data. We've done a whole lot of extra work on the investment sector of the market, which is very, very interesting. So, you know, people need to come back this time next week to hear about that, because that's where we're going to go through it for the first time. So.
Yeah. And well, look, we've joked about the central banks buying Australian property to help prop it up. But in a way, that's what they'll be doing if we're giving the money to the governments who are then bailing out all these institutions and having to put, you know, if you end up with a bad bank or whatever, where you just start throwing all to these things in.
I'm sure good bad banks, you know, take the bad loans, hold them separately from the banks. That'll be part of it. Plus, of course, just throwing more funds at the banks as well to keep them floating. What they will try to do is to stop house prices sliding too far this side of the election.
Yes.
Because you don't want to go to an election with house prices down. That's just, you know, something politicians wouldn't want to see. So they'll throw everything at it to try and keep things high for a period of time. The question is, what happens after that? And that's the big unknown question.
Mm.
Here's an interesting one. So I can get this up. Australian banks totally exposed to commercial property? ? Yeah, we don't often hear about discussions of commercial property. Probably worth thinking about that, because it's quite a big section of the overall exposure.
Yeah, I think that what I'm hearing on this, on the commercial property side, and what we're seeing from looking at some of the real estate trusts as well, is that they're not as anywhere near as exposed as they have been in the last two big cycles. So 1991, you know, almost took Westpac under, and a lot of the other banks. 2007 was a real wake up call for a lot of them who'd lent a lot to this commercial property sector. There's definitely risks in it, but it's not the same as what it was in those. I don't think it's going to be the epicenter. A lot of the gearing you're seeing in REITs is a lot lower, and I think the commercial departments have got enough. They still have the corporate memory of the 2007, that they haven't sort of gone overboard on that market. Having said that, there's definitely going to be you know, a number of areas in offices and in retail, where you're going to see a lot of bad debts. I guess what it is, I do think, by and large, the banks have got enough buffer that if they get hit, it won't be a big hit. So it's a bit different in that. And I guess where I'm coming from is if you've lent 30% of a property or 50%, which is in commercial property at the moment is quite out there, then the property has to fall either 70% or till the banks start losing some money. And so it's not the same as in the residential market, where you have these very high leverage amounts as a matter of course. Whereas it's very, very rare you get that in the commercial property sector. So yes, there'll be problems. I don't think it will be the epicenter, but it'll just be one more place sucking capital out of banks at the wrong point in time.
again. Yeah, and of course, I'm watching very interestingly the retail end of there. So a lot of those real estate trusts are in retail, you know, these big you know, areas where you've got so many shops now vacant with
yes.
no prospect of them being relet.
Yeah.
So you wonder about the returns from those particular commercial investments.
Oh, the bad returns, absolutely. But I guess it's this point, it's an overall point about economies in terms of saying, if you've got economies where you've got mostly equity holders and a little bit of debt holders at the end, it tends to be a lot more resilient to these big downturns in terms of equity holders of, you know, the banks aren't getting hit because the equity holders are taking the losses. The equity holders are people who were mostly not doing it geared, and so they're the people that were running the risks that they're intending to. Whereas the bigger crises generally happen where it starts hitting that you've got mostly debt and there's not much equity, and so the equity holders get wiped out quickly, and now you're into the debt holders. And then the banks start running into problems because the banks can't draw down the capital, and that's where they generally start to spiral out of control. And so we see that in corporates in the US. We see that in to a certain extent in Australia, but the US is much worse. We see that happening in households, particularly in Australia. There's some emerging markets where you see it in the government debt, but the collateralized loan areas, you know, there are some issues in there, but I think the key one I'm worried about the commercial property isn't one of the top of the ones on my list that I'm watching.
Very interesting. Okay, here's another one. The questions are coming in thick and fast, so I'm trying to get them up as much as I can get them up. This is one from Cool Hand Bruce. How is it that the banks have been able to, quote, screw depositors while spoiling mortgage clients? In other words, the mortgage rates are really low. Deposit rates are even lower, right? And in fact, I did a thing on the ABC on the radio talking specifically about the issues relating to the lower returns from what happened there? It stopped. Lower returns from banks. Of course, NAB announced that they were actually looking probably for a lower return than previously.
And
lower returns from the finance sector, lower margins, while they try and extend their reach into the loans as far as they can, giving up on deposits because that's all they can do. The bank's contribution to investment and superannuation pools presumably will be lower ahead than what they've been traditionally.
Yeah, so for me, the thing to remember with banks is that banks make money. They make money on how steep the yield curve is. So what that basically means is they're borrowing from people on a short-term basis and they're lending out to people on a long-term basis. So when yields are high on longer-term debt, then they make more money. And when yields are lower on short-term debt, yields are low on short-term debt so they can borrow cheaply, and high on longer-term, they make lots of money. And so it doesn't really matter where that moves up and down. You know, the interest rates can be 5%, they can be 10%. The banks can still be making that spread. What the problem is, though, is as that gets lower and lower, it hits the zero lower bound. And so that bottom part where they're funding themselves hits zero and doesn't stop, and then the long-term bit keeps coming down. And so the banks are making less on their money. So so that's the big issue for the banks, is the returns they're going to make, because they just don't make money when the yield curve is what they call quite flat. The banks don't make a lot of money, and so they're not as incentivized to actually lend. And that's exactly where Europe's been for the last 5-6 years, in that they've got to try and the central banks have got to try and keep their yield curve steep enough that the banks can actually make money, because otherwise all this buying of government debt doesn't get out into the real economy. And so that's why they've been experimenting with negative rates and things like that, really just trying to help prop up the bank's profitability to give them some incentive to get out and lend. And so, the zero lower bound problem, they call it. And it's just that real problem you have is that if you're stuck with interest rates low and not getting the demand because of it, then your banking sector is going to struggle and to make money, and they're not going to be incentivized to lend themselves.
Yeah, well, it's worth just exploring negative rates. I had a few questions on that. So, you know, the Fed is saying, no, 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 we're not going to go into negative rates. Of course, the Fed wouldn't, because the Fed's owned by the banks, and the banks have profitability issues when rates go negative. So there's a, yep. no surprise there. The Bank of England basically 1 week said, no, we're not going to do negative rates. The next week said, we might. And then they've changed their tune a bit further. So they're sort of vacillating. Canada's saying, no, 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 no. And Australia's saying, no, 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 no. What's your view? Do you think that negative rates ultimately will come here?
Well, I hope not. I think negative rates to me are a sign that the central banks are trying everything they possibly can, and the governments aren't helping. They're not actually stepping up and spending. So where we've seen negative rates so far has been in Europe, where the governments have been limited in terms of what they can do in terms of the how far they can go into debt because of the European Union rules. And so it's really the central bank trying to sort of get around those and trying to create some trying to just do something more. So the issue I have is I hope all those places are right, and that will be because governments will actually be trying to get out and spend money in order to get the economy going again, and in order to reduce inequality and other factors, which I think will be successful in terms of bringing us out of this. And so I think certainly within the US there's been a every second week it seems like another $1 trillion on the pile to help sort of get the economy going again. It obviously needs to be done intelligently, and you needs to be in the right projects and all that, which there's, I won't try and stand up and say that every single thing they've done is to the right people and will definitely result in good outcomes. But I think negative rates will be, they're possible, but they'll be a sign that the governments aren't working.
Again,
that's right. So yes, so that means yes, government interest rates probably will come here. Then it will. Anyway.
Well, it's fascinating. I mean, there are people in Europe now who basically are saying negative rates aren't working. It's actually stopping the banks lending. It's making them take higher risks because they're trying to speculate to get returns. They can't take rates lower on deposits because people just don't keep money in the banking system. By the way, that's why the cash bans. An important discussion there. It really is. We're on a really wacky territory. Now, there's a few questions relating to the Opal Tower, and not necessarily totally investment related, but be interested in your perspective. You may realise that the Olympic Committee and the Olympic New South Wales Olympic Board effectively is now being sued by the
right.
The Opal Towers, right? Which is something I predicted with Edwin Almeida a couple of years ago when we started talking about this, because ultimately they were responsible for the situation with regards to the layout of the land and the ultimate planning and everything else. But what's your perspective in terms of, like Opal Tower, where we've got poor construction, risks in the construction sector, lack of supervision of construction. I mean, is that a risk that you would sort of factor into your investment strategy, or do you think that's a bit disconnected from your day-to-day work, as it were?
Well, regulatory capture is certainly something we look at, and there's I'm just trying to think whether I named too many names, but look, there's a big transport company in Australia which is does a lot of toll roads, and I always like to, I'm not quite sure if I'm joking or not, but I like to say they're the masters of offering governments, let me give you an extremely good deal up until the next election, and then an extremely poor deal after that. And governments love to take that deal every time. They're like, oh, till the next election, that's all I need, then it's somebody else's problem. And I think that's regulatory capture across banks, regulatory across planning, all these areas, and even within government ministers, then moving into private sectors and financial services and a whole bunch of range of different ones, helps drive returns in those sectors. And I personally would love to see that reversed. But we're not really seeing, concrete signs of that happening. And they say, never waste a good crisis. you would like to think that this would be that all these problems would mean that we need to put it back in, you know, a centrally regulated on so at least large developments that might affect, you know, hundreds of people. But it seems as if we're quite possibly going the other direction in terms of trying to fast track a bunch of projects in order for economic stimulus to get that pushed out there. So yeah, I think the answer is yes. I would love to see less regulatory capture and that we didn't see this drift back between governments and private sort of ending up with worse outcomes for everyone. But until I actually see that start to happen, you know, we have to invest on the basis that it will continue to happen and that governments will continue to be offered, you know, poor choices and they will accept them.
Well, there's no doubt that the amount of money that's been thrown at the construction sector, you know, both at a state level and at a federal level, far outweighs the very paltry amount they've thrown at the entertainment sector, right, which was capped, whereas the others is uncapped. And in fact, I'm doing a program tomorrow with the ABC on 7:30 to deal with this question of Western Australia, who also threw extra money into incentives to buy off the plan.
Right.
And what's happened over there is that the price of land has gone up by the amount of the extra incentive.
Yes, as we see every time, but we
it's happening. It's a zero sum game, right? Yeah. You know, you basically end up with the, you end up with the, nobody wins, right? It just shifts the problem around. So,
yeah, well, existing homeowners win. Yes, that's which is a lot of the voting public, and so, I guess it's that same thing with first home buyers grants, isn't it? We know where they end up, and all the academic sort of stuff backs that up. But governments still persist in giving them because it makes people feel as if makes the first home buyers feel as if something's being done for them, and increases the price for everyone else. And so, in their view, everyone's a winner. But the net effect is everyone pays higher rents, and it's a net. Having high property prices is a net negative on economies because you're just increasing the cost of doing business. You're increasing you're decreasing the number of staff you can hire because you need to spend so much on rent. You're doing less development in Australia because it's cheaper to do it elsewhere. High property prices are a net negative for the Australian economy. From the way we look at stocks and the way we look at economies, but there's no real signs that, except if they collapse under their own weight, which, you know, I'm hopeful we will see some signs of that. But there's certainly no government policies around trying to reverse that trend.
Yep, very, very right. And of course, the issue is that the more property sucks investment and funds, the less there is to invest elsewhere. There's less that is invested in other productive capabilities that the country needs. People have less to spend, so that means the discretionary spending goes down as well. So it's I use the analogy of a black hole. It sucks more and more and more in, right?
Yeah, and you're entrepreneurs. Like, you know, nobody's sitting here dreaming, going, oh, yeah, let me start my new software company or set up a new new manufacturer, high-end manufacturer or whatever. They're all sitting there going, I wonder if I bought that house, slapped a new coat of paint on it when I could flip it and make 50 grand. And they're saying, well, if that's your idea of entrepreneurism, then you're losing out as an economy and as a society. We're losing out from that.
Absolutely. Now, there's a whole bunch of people who've asked similar sorts of questions about the Great Reset. In other words, there is a theory to say that basically we're going to get to the point where the current system goes kaboom and something else comes in and takes its place, whether that's deliberate, whether it's an accident, whether it's a plot, or whether it's not. What's your perspective on the concept of a Great Reset?
A Great Reset. Look, let me start that, break that into two parts. One part's a political part, and the other part is a debt part. So what generally tends to happen in economic cycles is you get debt go through these short-term debt cycles and then long-term debt cycles. And so the short-term debt cycles, you see debt build up. You generally at the top see interest rates rising and then something happens and you go into a recession and the debt levels fall again and then you start the next rise up again. The issue is that you then go through this longer-term debt cycle where each trough is higher than the previous trough. and each cycle peak is higher than the previous one. And these tend to sort of last 50, 60 odd years. And then you finally have this big sort of cathartic end to the debt cycle, and you get either debt forgiveness, massive amounts of inflation, or government spending to sort of get rid of all these debts, and then you start your next big cycle. So there's lots of good arguments saying this is we're reaching that point, and this could be the point where we go through this next big debt cycle. Look, I hope it is, mainly because if it's not, and we do throw even more debt at the problem, then the next cycle is going to be, we're going to go through this another cycle, and the pain when it finally comes will be even bigger. So that's sort of one side is trying to say what's happening on the debt side. Will we reach this end? I think we're probably at least 50-50 on it this time around. A lot of people thought 2007 was that point, but obviously we just sort of kicked the can and kept building up the debt in other areas. So maybe on that side. I think there's a very much a political side to that though as well, which is the inequality side. And inequality has this natural drift in terms of so people end up with more money, and then they equate some more political power, and then you keep pushing and they get more, and so you end up with these broad divides. And we see a lot about those in terms of Gini coefficients and just wealth gaps and things like that as time goes on. My personal take is that what the last time we saw that big inequalities, communism was really one of the drivers. And throughout the 60s and 70s, you saw quite low levels of inequality in a lot of democratic countries and places like the US and Australia and Britain, because there was this real fear that if you didn't give equality, then what you would see is communism come to those countries. And so you needed constrained capitalism, which gives you these great rates of growth and spreads the wealth around. The problem I think we're facing is that we've been through this period of the last 10, 15 years where communism is basically no longer a threat, and capitalism can therefore have unfettered access to whatever it wants. And I think that's where the dangers come, is that it will be its own downfall. I think that this is coming soon? And so political change. Again, I hope so, but I'm probably more cynical on the political change. We saw the rise of the 1% change in 2007. Occupy Wall Street and all these factors, and I thought, maybe there will be a bit of a push, but that died away pretty quickly, to be honest. This time around, we have seen people are obviously frustrated. We're seeing a lot a lot of race and a lot of equality issues in terms of when I say equality, not in terms of not economic inequality, but more equality of between genders and other factors. And in a way, I think that's taking some of the oxygen out of the debate. I'm not saying those ones are very important, but that's taking a lot of the oxygen out of the room for economic equality. And so I think we're probably stuck with where we are on the economic equality, unless something sort of comes out of the blue. Bernie Sanders was a big supporter of this, but he didn't make it through the US process. I think from that perspective, there's on the political side, there's still a few more years to wait, unfortunately.
Well, on that, you may have seen that the AFR did an assassination piece on Alan Kohler, right?
Yes.
Because Alan reviewed Stephanie's book on MMT.
Yes.
Right. And it really came down to, a polarization of views between Alan, who said, look, I'm not advocating it, but it's interesting to consider compared with the AFR's view that, no, you can't do that, because it doesn't go in line with their thinking. What's your perspective? Have you looked at MMT? Have you considered
I have, yeah. We had Dr. Stephen Hale on our podcast maybe 6 months ago to talk through some of the issues. Look, I think there's a lot to be said for the whole part about governments can spend money. Governments don't need to raise debt before they spend money. So, and the example, I like their example of, when Pearl Harbor got attacked and the US said, that's it, we're militarizing and we're going to spend all this money on going to war. They didn't turn around. The first step after Pearl Harbor wasn't oh, let's go and ask the debt markets, will you permit us to have this money so that we can actually go out and spend it and start a war, or, you know, join the war. So from my perspective, there is an element behind that. I think MMT gets demonized a lot in terms of saying it seems to be spend a little bit of money you don't have, and then the next steps, Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe. Whereas I think it's disingenuous that the step that people take to get from there to one to the next, in that, you know, don't let your kids hold hands, because next thing there's teenage pregnancy to worry about. And so I was saying, well, there's a lot of steps between holding hands and getting to teenage pregnancy. So I do think an amount of MMT, and in terms of MMT, I'm saying central banks printing money to give to governments to spend, or central banks printing money to give directly to people. My personal preference would be printing money, giving it to people as taxable income, so that governments end up with a bit, people end up with a bit, and you sort of get the rich get less than the poor, because of higher tax rates. I think that could be quite effective. But the issue is, are we close to that? And I don't think we are. I think they're certainly being discussed in circles. And I think that would work way better. I mean, the main thing MMT is all about trying to do is if you're going to print money, get it out to the people, whether you're doing that through the government who can then spend on programs, or whether you're doing it directly to people. Don't go and buy assets and prop up asset prices with the hope that eventually some of that will trickle down and help the rest of the economy. Because if anything, the last 10 years have shown us, or the last 13 years have shown us, is no, it doesn't really help. It certainly helps things from getting terrible, and it helps things from imploding, but it doesn't actually solve the situation. The more debt is not a solution to the situation. You actually need that inflation, and you need that that money going somewhere where genuinely people could spend it, rather than just going into bidding asset prices higher.
I think that's the key point. You know, if you actually generate liquidity and you just throw it into the financial system to inflate assets, that's not productive. If you use some of that funding that you created to invest in real productive things that could create growth for the future and real momentum and real jobs, that's a completely different story. That part of the story, to me, doesn't get told enough, in my view, in this debate, because it gets too polarized and too doctrinal, right? But it seems to me it's a question of what do you do with the money.
Exactly, exactly. And can you get that to people who are actually genuinely going to spend it?
Exactly, because that's what you need.
Yeah.
Now, this is one from Cookie Boy. What's your prediction on the Aussie dollar?
Look, I'm expecting it to go lower. I think there's the biggest issue with it is Brazil and the iron ore in Brazil. So I think X that. So the Australian economy is from an external point of view. If you're a global investor, you look upon Australia as being a bit of a supercharged version of the world economy, in that it's heavily reliant on resources, and so when world growth is good, Australian economy goes very well. When world growth is poor, Australian economy goes very poorly, and the Aussie dollar generally accelerates that. So good economic circumstances, the Aussie dollar shoot higher. Poor economic circumstances, it will go lower. So as an overall, certainly expecting it to be lower. The big disclaimer is, if Brazil, which is having a really torrid time of the with the coronavirus, goes offline in terms of their iron ore, then the Aussie dollar is going up. So that's your biggest swing factor, because so much of Australia is based on, so much of our exports are based on the iron ore and government revenue from royalties. It's hard to see how that could. But having said that, if it does, it is a short-term issue. So as long as you have a negative view on the world economy, and we do, then we're expecting Aussie dollar lower.
Okay, and does that also depends on what the US dollar is going to do? Because it seems to me that the other side of the equation, you know, one goes up, one goes down, but often it's what happens to the US dollar. And if you think we've got the virus raging in the US, you've got the election coming up later in the year, you've got unemployment now at 16%, according to the revised unofficial figures that they came out with, which was higher than the 13 point something that they actually quoted.
Yep.
So you wonder about the sort of the foundations of the US economy, and therefore the US dollar as well.
Yeah, look, the other one that I did mention actually is that you know, everyone's trying to devalue their currency at the moment, and the US seems to be keener to do that than most others. Their central banks are out pumping as much money as they can into the economy, whereas the Australian Central Bank is still, you know, a fair bit behind in terms of what it's trying to do. So we're not sort of playing the same game in terms of trying to devalue our currency as much. Having said all that, I still am of the belief that if you get when you get financial shocks, that the US dollar will rise, because it's a home bias effect in the US. I mean, we saw the financial crisis where, you know, the whole the epicenter of the crisis was the US, but the US dollar still rose. And so I expect that will still be a feature. If it's a long, slow grinding and central banks keep propping the stock market up, then the Aussie's probably not going to fall very far. But because it's not playing the same game as everyone else. I still think if you're worried about a crisis and bigger shocks in terms of world stock markets, and we are, then the Aussie dollar is more likely to go down than up.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you for that one. And Paul has asked another question. Can I ask you whether investments in foreign EFTs on the ASX are a real way to achieve diversity?
Look, I mean, we've got portfolios. We run direct portfolios for clients. So we go out and buy the international stocks ourselves. Having said that, though, for clients with very small balances, it doesn't make sense because they just can't get enough diversification. And so we'll put those clients and use exchange traded funds within those. So my personal preference is where I can. I don't, because what I find is that I can get exposure to the places I want. And where I'm looking, say, in international portfolios at the moment is US is expensive. There's some very, very high quality stocks there, so I don't mind getting some exposure to some of those. But the market itself is very expensive compared to, say, Europe, and particularly some of the peripheral Europe, some of the non-Euro countries. And so if I can pick up some more exposure in those countries, then I will. So from that perspective, I prefer not to. Where the portfolio is big enough to justify it. But yeah, I don't have a problem. Having said that, you know, you do need to be careful about what funds you're buying. There are some funds out there, especially some of the smart beta ones that have very specific exposures, and you might be getting exposure that you don't really know what you're getting. So you might be ending up with something where the ETF is actually buying most of the market, and so it's actually driving the market itself. But some of the broader ones, say the S&P 500 ones, you might get. Or the world MSCI World Index, they're big enough and liquid enough and playing in enough markets that you'll get a decent exposure if that's what you're looking for.
Right, and I guess you've also got to be a little bit careful with regard to the fee structures around some of them too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You shouldn't be paying big fees if you're going to pay for an ETF.
That's the whole point.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I think the S&P 500 one. Look, it was 9 basis points. I think I have the suspicion it might even be 5 basis points, which is 0.05%. So you're paying nothing in terms of the costs on it. An afterthought. You'll pay more on the spread probably of buying in and selling out than what you do on it.
Yeah, well, I always say to people, check that, because not all of them are as well behaved as that.
No.
You can actually end up paying through the nose for something that you probably thought was meant to be lower cost. And end up with higher costs. And of course, the more that the costs erode the returns, it blows the whole value proposition up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the overall part with investment. What you find is that there's lots of debate about, you know, how much fund managers add or don't add. But by and large, my take is that fund managers will outperform on average. And then in aggregate, though, they take it all back in fees. So you find ones that, like ourselves, that we try and be lower cost, and you know, our performance sort of has been exceptional this year, since inception. Can't say it's always going to be that way, but charging that low fee though makes a huge difference in terms of what you're getting, because if you're paying sort of 2% and some sort of performance fee as well, then the fund managers do really, really well out of it, but the investor doesn't do quite as well.
Mm. Well, I've done some modelling to show the impact of those fees, right? And the returns you get over a long period of time, allowing for compounding, is hugely different just by those variations in fees. And yet, quite often, people are not actually clear on what they're actually paying and, you know, all those sorts of things. So it's very important to understand that.
Absolutely. And I've done a few pieces on performance fees. And I guess we're a little bit different in that because we're running quite a low-risk core portfolio, we definitely don't think in our space you should be charging performance fees because, you know, I helped start this fund. You know, I'm a major shareholder in it. It's very important for me to be successful. If I had performance fees, some years they'll come, some years they won't. I'm not going to go out and hire a bunch of analysts based on performance fees in one or spend more money on analysis or do whatever it is. It's, you know, the funds that the fund's using to generate performance just based on performance fees. That performance fee is going into my back pocket and I'm taking it home because I don't know if it's going to be there next year. And so that performance fee, some people think, oh yeah, but I'm incentivizing my fund manager to perform better. You're not. You're incentivizing him to take more risks. There's so many studies out there that have shown, you know, paying somebody to work harder, that works generally, paying people more to work harder. Paying people to be smarter doesn't work. So it doesn't matter, you know, fund managers are out there trying to do their best regardless. If you say, you know, here you go, here's a chance to double and triple your income if you do well, they're already being as smart as they can. What that means is they'll probably just run a bit more risk with the view that, you know, if they do really well, then they make huge profits. But if they don't do well, you didn't lose anything anyway because it was all in performance fees.
Net sum game, I think, is the sum for that one. Now, a couple of people are asking, what's your perspective on where home prices are going to go over the next 12 to 24 months? There you go.
Yeah, well, look, we've got a home price calculator on our website that sort of does all these different scenarios. And the key thing that you get out of that when you play around with it, we sort of give you, I think we've got five different scenarios, everything from, you know, a poor economic outcome to property paradise where interest rates stay low and growth doesn't fall away type thing. The real thing you notice is that given how high property prices are at the moment, if you've got debt on that property, and most people I'm assuming will, it's very hard to get positive outcomes. So basically, you know, even in the best scenarios, you're looking at property prices that are basically maybe paying for the debt price that you've got on it. So and the downside is considerably worse. So I guess I would say in terms of what I'm looking for, I'm looking more for the sort of so what's the time frame? Was it a year?
12 to 24 months.
Yeah, I'd be looking more for I think a 20% chance is a 20% fall is a significant probability. And on the other side, though, I think that probably the next most likely is maybe about a 5% fall. I think in between that's, I guess what I'm looking at, it's either going to build up this head of steam on the downside and get away from regulators and get away from governments, and you're going to see this sort of 20% fall, or you're going to see governments get there fast enough and throw, as we spoke about before, as much possible support just to hold this thing where it is for as long as they can. And then you're sort of back in that sort of 5, maybe 10% fall where it's not quite getting away, but not quite safe.
Well,
and between that, I don't think there's much of a, I don't think the odds in between that is hard to see.
Yeah. Well, as you know, I run different scenarios and there's a scenario where I see there's a little upside, not much, but a little bit over the next couple of years. The question is how far on the downside, and it goes back to your point, will they be able to stop it falling? Because if the gravitational forces get sufficiently large with unemployment and bad debts and all those things, it's going to be very hard to keep property prices high. Remember, investors aren't buying.
No.
You know, the data today showed that investor lending is falling away again. In fact, total credit dropped this month. This came out today in the data today. First time since, you know, forever, a long time. So that's a concern. And then, of course, if the broader economy is still being hit by COVID wave 2, wave 3, wave 4, because, you know, they've locked down Victoria today, or parts of Victoria at least, those are the things. That's why it's impossible to say for sure where on that spectrum we're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And Chinese buyers disappearing as well. Certainly lots of pressure from Chinese government for Chinese buyers not to come in. So, yeah. There's a it seems like a pretty good storm building, and I don't think we've got much of a shelter. So
okay. And then the other question that a few people have been asking you, another: where will it be ASX in 12 months' time? This time next year, where do you think? Higher, lower?
No, lower. I'm going for a lower on that. I think in terms of it certainly underperformed the international market this year by about, well, it's about 15% underperformance. I think the ASX was down about 10% over the year. International was down. Oh, sorry, was up slightly. Currency driven. So I do think that's one. If we're right in terms of the currency, I think that will help buffer you. But we're still keener to look offshore than what we're in Australia. In terms of Australian PEs, so price to earnings ratios, they're at record highs. So we've never seen valuations this high in Australia. I think there's not much happening on the earnings front. I think if earnings are basically, well, from where forward earnings are, if they come good with those forecasts, I think it would be very surprising. At that basis, if the market came back to its average PE, it would need to fall about maybe 30%. So I guess I'm quite nervous about the whole Australian market in terms of where its exposures are in terms of financials and resources, and just the valuations that they're priced on at this point in time.
Now, it's very interesting because if you apply those same rationales, long-term averages and, over the peak, as it were, you can say that of home prices, you can say that of the stock markets, right? And of course, both are being inflated by policy, by very low interest rates, and by massive liquidity.
Yep.
And so it's a question of, put all that turn the blender on and see what comes out.
Yeah. And so, there is an argument about saying, well, eventually the economy will come good. And so therefore, if I buy at these prices, they'll be back there, or the markets will hold higher. Look, maybe it will. It'd be the first time ever it's happened in the stock market, for sure. The stock market usually prices things pretty quickly, and it says, well, whatever's happening over the next year or so, the future is very uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years' time, so we'll price for the next year or two. At the moment, that's not happening, which is extremely rare. That's an argument to always buy, though. Because if you accept that argument, you'd say at every point in time, should I buy today? Well, yes, because the stock market will be higher eventually. And so you can, it's always an argument to buy straight away. But having said that, it's not quite fair, but the ASX peaked out at sort of 6,800, I think, back in 2007. So we're still not back to there. The NASDAQ in the US took sort of 13, 14 years to get back to its peak in the tech boom. So, you pick the wrong level, and it could take, decades to get back in terms of prices. We think at the moment that the market is in a bubble and that the prices are way too high. And so, all of our superannuation clients and all of our ordinary investors, we're doing what we can in our portfolios to mitigate that risk without sort of, just sitting it all in cash. Because we do think there are other assets that have got some, that are attractive enough to want to buy at these points.
Yeah, well, I think it'll be a really interesting year, and so many unknowns, right? I think back over my sort of lifetime of looking at finance, and the number of variables and the number of risks probably have never been as extreme as they are today.
It's been how long since unemployment was at these levels? Well, certainly, let's say underemployment, because I think I prefer to look at underemployment, because I think that's a better measure of less affected by statistical issues. Mm-hmm. Hasn't been this high for what, 90 years?
Correct.
Valuations have never been this high. Mm-hmm. So I sort of it's basically the biggest disconnect you've ever seen in terms of those two. Which is where we settle on the idea. Well, look, it is a bubble, and now it's just a question of how long it takes to deflate, and what could be the pins that pop it.
Yeah, and then of course the question is, over the last decade or so, we've had rates come down, 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 down. We've had liquidity thrown into the market left, right, and centre.
Yep.
But none of those can continue. So therefore, we're at a bit of an interesting juncture in terms of how it evolves from this point.
Yeah, exactly. And that's that long-term debt cycle they're saying, you know, if we go for one more, and as I said, I don't think we can, but maybe we can, then the next one's going to be even worse. So, yeah, having said that, you know, if we do go into one more, then, yeah, you have a, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 year run at it at least before it turns okay. again.
Yeah, great. So just we're coming up to the end now. Just a couple of quick fire ones. BlackRock and the Fed. What do you think about that?
Oh, we might want to expand on that one.
Basically, the Fed is unable to buy secondary market bonds, so they're using BlackRock.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I sort of my take is I want to see money in the hands of the real people. The Fed's got to. They've got to make sure at the moment that the debt markets don't lock up, and so they're doing what they can. I think it's no longer their job, and it hasn't been their job for years. We should have flipped across to governments and getting out to spend and get inflation going from the ground up, but they haven't, and so I think they're going to go in the path of Japan. If the governments don't step up and start really spending the money, then at some stage they'll probably be buying equities. So if you don't like what's happening now, you know, just stop watching, because you're either going to see governments step in, and the most likely place for that to happen is the US, I think, in terms of they've obviously been very happy to keep throwing another trillion. Who's to say, you know, you really do need to be on the political side. The amount of uncertainty you spoke about, you know, what we're really trying to do in a way is say, look, we know what the scenarios are, and we know what happens if this and this and this happens. Now, what is going to happen? What are these couple of people at the Fed or a couple of people in government actually going to decide to do? Because that's really what's going to drive markets from here and drive returns over the next few years. You've got all your scenarios, you know, Martin, which you know, are very good, and I like to see them all. But as I think you'd admit, most of those are in a large part dependent upon a few decisions at either a central bank or a government as to which way it's going to go.
Well, of course, that's the whole point of scenarios, right? And it's impossible to predict, because, well, you can guess where governments are going to put the dollars sometimes, election cycles and what have you. But nevertheless, there are so many variables.
Yeah, and it's not a decision. It's not a part where a lot of other economic variables, you can say, okay, here's the way the cycle goes, and here's what generally happens at this point. And so you can make a reasonably educated guess. Whereas at this point, it's saying, well, somebody at the Fed or somebody at the RBA will decide either A or B. If they decide A, this will happen. If they decide B, this will happen.
I mean, it is that binary, and it is actually a political decision. I mean, although the Fed is objective and independent, yeah, sure. There is a political overlay here that will actually determine the outcome, I think. And I think quite often people assume that the economists know and can predict, but actually, you're right. It's those externalities that really you've got very little control over. You have to react to them.
Yeah. And then given, I mean, this putting in for anyone who is investing at the moment, is because interest rates are so low and asset prices are so high, you know, the expected return across a whole range of asset classes, whether it be houses or shares or bonds or cash, is also very, very low. It's actually going to be really important over the next few years to be quite tactical about not just saying, oh, well, it's all too hard, I'll just keep buying and hopefully it'll all sort itself out. You know, from our view, where we generally try and target about a third of our portfolio to turn over in any one year, third or less, that we don't really want to do much market movements. But we've sort of been increasingly telling people it's probably going to be more over the next few years, just because you're going to get these wild swings in markets, and there's so little returns out there that you just need to be a bit more tactical about how you're approaching investment markets now.
Yeah. Now, great. And then the last question is, what are the sort of the two or three leading indicators that you'll be looking at really, really closely over the next, 12 to 18 months as you begin to craft your strategy? Are there particular indicators that you hang your hat on?
Yeah, sure. I think the big one, and it's unfortunate that so unemployment is the key thing we're watching at the moment. The unfortunate thing is unemployment's the most lagging of all economic indicators. It tends to be the last thing to turn in any cycle. And so we're trying to look for sort of forward indicators that give us an idea of unemployment and talking to people and companies and really trying to get a handle on that, because how far that unemployment goes down and how far that real amount is, even after you've taken into account job seekers and job keepers and all these other factors, is really what's going to determine it. So the percentage growth rates you're seeing right now, you can almost throw them out the window, because when a market falls by 50% and then rises by 50%, it sounds really good, but it's actually fallen from 100 down to 50 and then it's risen back up to 75. So the whole look, trying to compare percentage movements when they're so large, gets really difficult. So what we're trying to really focus on is baselining where things were and trying to work out where they can get back to. And so that's sort of that whole part about unemployment's going to be the key driver for that, because once unemployment gets to a certain level, it just takes years and years and years to come back.
Yeah, well, I think we're pretty much there anyway. But look, I want to say firstly, thank you very much for your contribution here tonight. And the chat has been very positive in terms of your comments and your opinions, which is great. We didn't get to all the questions, but you never do. But we certainly covered some really, really good ground. Now, if people want to hear more, you run a weekly podcast, right?
Yeah, we run a weekly podcast as well. We're trying to get on people who have other opinions similar to ours or very different, and just to discuss what they're seeing and try and talk through the types of investment issues that we're looking at, because we're just trying to keep people up to speed with our investment thinking. So you can see that it's on youtube.com/nucleuswealth. I'm on Twitter, Damien Klassen, or at Damien Klassen. And you can, we on our website, nucleuswealth.com, we've got all our, there's LinkedIn's and Facebook's and all the social medias.
And there's a couple of previous shows that you and I recorded together on the DFA channel as well. So
absolutely. And we've had Martin was on maybe a month ago, was it?
Yeah, so, that's right. Last time I updated the stress data. So we sort of share ideas. And I think the point to make from my perspective too is that what I like about this conversation is how transparent and open it is, and the fact that we both recognize that there are lots of unknown unknowns here, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Not trying to call it and say, I'm sure it's going to be X, because there are too many variables. And I think that's the final take I want to leave everybody with. We are in a period of great uncertainty, and uncertainty perhaps steers us towards caution rather than actually running towards a particular solution and saying it's definitely going to be X or Y.
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm just going to finish the show now, and I'll just come back to my full camera here. There we go. Thank you very much, Damien. I had a really great conversation tonight. Just so everybody understands that next week, I'll be updating the mortgage stress and rental stress data, and including a lot of information relating to the investment sector, which I've done a lot of analysis on for the first time. And it's really interesting and quite scary. So that'll be worth watching. Same time next week. So come along for that if you're interested. I want just to say to Big Tam, Ron, and Nifi, thank you very much for your contributions through the stream tonight, and also to Plexus for moderating. Thank you once again to Nucleus Wealth for letting you come and talk with us today. And wish you a very pleasant evening. And I'm just going to sign off. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and we'll see you again next time.